From WNYC in New York, this is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. When the executive order, often called the Muslim ban, was signed by Donald Trump on January 27th, he proudly and loudly proclaimed,
"New vetting measures to keep radical Islamic terrorists out of the United States of America. We don't want them here."
A surprise announcement, complete with lights, camera, and action. But the action swiftly occurred in precincts he couldn't control.
Breaking news, travel ban backlash. Protests and lawsuits.
President Trump's executive order went into effect overnight, leaving as many as 200 travelers stranded.
Thousands of demonstrators are at Philadelphia International Airport protesting.
The ban was challenged in court. Multiple federal judges deemed it unconstitutional, and there the matter rested for a while. This past Monday, Trump signed a new ban, relaxing restrictions for legal residents and removing Iraq from the list of banned countries.
And unlike the dramatic rollout of the first version, this executive order was signed quietly out of the media spotlight.
The president has not taken questions. The White House didn't have an on-camera briefing. You can see just undeniably a different tone.
And the response has been similarly subdued.
Trump's travel ban has now been released with much less chaos than the last one.
No visible signs of outrage here at JFK's Terminal 4, at least not yet.
No longer a Muslim ban, this was a travel ban. And yet, in many respects, the second ban is likely to accomplish the same goals as the first, the very goals that nettled the courts. Dahlia Lithwick writes about the courts and the law for Slate and hosts the Amicus podcast. Dahlia, welcome back to OTM.
Hi there, Brooke.
So let's start with the optics. Trump didn't make a public appearance to sign the executive order. Instead, it was Homeland Security Secretary John Kelly, Secretary of State Rex Tillerson, and Attorney General Jeff Sessions that cut the ribbon, so to speak. But there were other tweaks to the visuals, right?
There were a couple of tweaks, and all of them, I think, were in the vein of appearing not crazy, I think is the technical term, after the spectacular dumpster fire that was the first rollout. It's not an accident that you had three agency chiefs, because last time there was huge question about whether the agencies even knew what was going on. So it was very much like, we're all on the same page, trust us here, boom, we're out. I think the media is like, hey, look, that went fairly well. There aren't people being seized at airports and separated from their children this time.
It isn't going to be implemented for at least a few days so people can change their travel plans and won't be stuck at the airport waiting for the ACLU to bail them out.
That's right. You're not going to have people who got on the airplane in Djibouti and got off the airplane and were told, oh, we live in a different universe. This doesn't go into effect until March 16th to make sure there isn't going to be that level of mayhem, because I think that mayhem really, really hurt the administration, both in terms of optics and I think later on in the courts. So you're not going to have illegal permanent residents. You're not going to have people who have already been vetted for 2 years and are holding visas who are now going to be shipped back. And I think the best way to think about the new 2.0 travel ban is to realize that it was really kind of reverse engineered. This was jerry-rigged in order to satisfy the questions that the courts had raised in the over one dozen lawsuits after the first ban.
Is this new executive order any less of a Muslim ban than the first one was?
If you only look at the four corners of the order, they have taken out the things that were really, truly constitutionally quite scary. Not only were we only targeting majority Muslim states, but we were going to give some kind of preference to disfavored minorities in those countries. It looked exactly like what Trump said it was, which is we're going to protect Christian minorities in Muslim countries. And that was vastly problematic. That stuff is out. If you just look at the paper itself, it doesn't look like an overt Muslim ban. So then that raises this really interesting question, Brooke, which is how much are judges going to be satisfied with instructions to just look at the four corners of this ban? there are a lot of judges who looked at the earlier ban and said, we're not going to close our eyes and pretend we don't know what animated this. And I should note that Hawaii was the first state this week to file litigation over the second ban, hoping that judges are not mollified. And in Hawaii, what they're saying in their pleading is, old wine, new bottle, please, judges, look at it for what it is.
Well, let's go over the legal problems with the first executive order. They couldn't find a clear connection between the seven countries, now six since Iraq's been taken off the list. They couldn't find a connection between those countries and domestic terrorism, which was the target of the ban.
In my view, that's the big lingering problem. You had Judge Leonid Brinkema in the Eastern District of Virginia saying, I cannot find a scintilla of evidence that this ban makes us safer from the kind of terrorism that they're purporting to make us safer from. And in both of these cases, you had the judges just imploring the lawyers for the government, show us evidence. Why this ban? Why target these seven countries? And there was just crickets. And so now you have statements that overtly say, oh, no, no, we have 300 persons who entered the U.S. as refugees that are now the subjects of counterterrorism investigations by the FBI. We can assert that this ban will make us safer from people like that. But we don't know who these 300 people are. We don't know that they entered from these six countries. We don't even know what it means to be the, quote, subject of a counterterrorism investigation. It may mean they're just being looked at.
You wrote that the text of the executive order attempts to go around these issues by citing evidence for the link between these countries and terrorism, and the cases just don't do it.
Right. The two specific examples. One is a case of, quote, two Iraqi nationals admitted to the United States as refugees in 2009. That is the Bowling Green massacre incident. And that doesn't prove any of the things the administration wants to prove, because that was not an attack on American soil. They were in Iraq at the time. And Iraqis would be exempted under this ban because Iraq is off the list. And then the second case, this alleged Christmas tree attack, they talk about it as, quote, a native of Somalia who'd been brought to the U.S. as a child refugee, absolutely makes the point that people who come here when they're 2 and 3 years old and then over a span of 20 years become radicalized in the U.S., those are not people that this ban can keep out. We can't know who those people are.
This was somebody from Somalia who'd come here as a toddler who, in Portland, Oregon, in 2010, tried to detonate a bomb at a Christmas tree lighting. Some think that it was kind of a sting because undercover agents posing as Al-Qaeda supplied him with a fake bomb.
We have DHS documents that were leaked last week that suggest that overwhelmingly, the kinds of people that we're worried about are people that we can't keep out this way.
Now, there has been a tendency for courts to generally defer to the president, but Trump has been so hostile to the courts. You think that the courts reviewing this case will be less deferential?
Courts give massive deference to the executive branch, particularly on, you know, matters of national security. But the playing field is a little funky this time because we've had such overt hostility right down to the threats against the Ninth Circuit judges and calling them so-called judges and saying, when the terror attack comes, you put it on them. When the president himself starts flinging insults, you tend to see judges really not just fear for their life and safety, which is a big part of this, but really brace themselves against attacks on judicial independence, judicial legitimacy, and they push back hard. We may see judges who might be apt to defer to the president, particularly on these national security matters. They may be apt to say, you know what, not this president, not this time.
So we're not seeing the magnitude of protests we saw the last time. We're not seeing as much coverage. If the fate of this executive order is in the hands of the courts, does it matter how much the public or even the media react?
I interviewed Mark Herring, who's Virginia's attorney general, and I asked him a version of your question. Does it matter to life-tenured Article III judges? And he said that he felt that public outcry, showing up at airports, lawyers working for free around the clock, made a massive difference. Because again, if I'm right, and the judicial branch is by design the weakest branch, they need to be bolstered by public outcry. They need to see that they're on the right side of history. We saw that with the gay marriage litigation. We've seen that time and time again, that it's incredibly important to remind judges that we care and that their legitimacy is not in question. Steve Bannon has said, oh, these protesters are going to wear themselves out. And I think that's the aspiration, is pass a less insane ban, get less media coverage, get vastly reduced blowback, and hope that the judges think, eh, this isn't the hill I want to die on. So it is a really, really good question about whether in the absence of the kind of public outcry we saw last month, judges are going to feel quite as emboldened to push back the way they pushed back on round one.
Dahlia, thank you so much.
Oh, it's a pleasure.
Dahlia Lithwick writes about the courts and the law for Slate and hosts the Amicus podcast.
Coming up, the evolution of the EPA in the public eye.
This is On the Media.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, cleaning, and even exercising. But what if you could be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average, and auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at Progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. One of the key aims of the White House and the Republican-led Congress over the last couple of months has been to roll back regulations deemed costly and detrimental to business. Nowhere has the axe come down harder than on the environmental rules.
President Trump signed an executive order on Tuesday. It directed the EPA to pull back Obama's Waters of the United States rule.
The act gives the federal government broad authority to limit pollution in major bodies of water, as well as in streams and wetlands.
The president repealed a rule meant to prevent coal mining waste from going into waterways.
Regulations to reduce car emissions are expected to be rolled back.
It's dead. There will be no federal program to reduce carbon dioxide or other greenhouse gas emissions.
Meanwhile, this week, EPA Administrator Scott Pruitt questioned the environmental impact of carbon dioxide produced by burning fossil fuels.
There's tremendous disagreement about the degree of impact. So no, I would not agree that it's a primary contributor to the global warming that we see.
A view that is, of course, at odds with the scientific community. Trump also says he wants to cut NASA's climate change research budget. Less information, less resistance. And the White House proposed chopping the Environmental Protection Agency's budget by 25%, eliminating some 3,000 jobs and slashing funds to states, further disabling the agency.
Completely eliminating a $4.8 million program to protect the San Francisco Bay.
On the East Coast, grant money used to clean up the badly polluted Chesapeake Bay, the country's largest estuary, could be slashed 93%. Washington State could see a 93% cut in grants used to clean up and protect the Puget Sound, from $28 million down to $2 million.
Quite the contrast to Ronald Reagan's approach during his second White House run in 1984.
The White House recognizes that the environment is a very potentially strong election year issue. It doesn't cut both ways like an abortion issue, where any stand you take can lose you as many voters as it wins. It's held strongly and dearly by a lot of people.
So how did we get here? how did protecting the environment go from an issue of near universal concern to a political football? And how did the EPA, an agency created by a Republican president, become, in the eyes of the GOP, a job killer? You got to go back to the late 60s.
When you drive along the highway, look around on either side. Just one glance and you'll see how this country's lost its pride.
In 1966, dozens in New York City died from oppressive smog over a single weekend, and other cities suffered too. In 1969, the Santa Barbara oil spill released an estimated 3 million gallons of crude oil into the ocean, damaged sea life, and spoiled California beaches.
This is a view inside Santa Barbara Harbor, showing pleasure boats that have turned black above their waterlines, where the crude oil lapped up against their hulls. The oil slick fouled nearly 50 kilometers of coastline.
Polluted waterways were clogged with flammable goo.
The Cuyahoga River in Ohio is so loaded with the waste products of petroleum distillation that it is actually in danger of catching fire.
In fact, fires on Cleveland's Cuyahoga River weren't rare, but a 1969 blaze caught the country's attention. Randy Newman penned an ironic serenade.
'Cause the Cuyahoga River goes smoking through my dreams. Burn on, big river, burn on.
It was a time of noxious, visible pollution. People cared. Nixon noticed.
The great question of the 70s is, shall we surrender to our surroundings, or shall we make our peace with nature and begin to make reparations for the damage we have done to our air, to our land, and to our water?
Beset by protests over the Vietnam War, civil rights, and women's rights, Nixon was in a bind.
And he saw environment as an opportunity to jump in front of this mob coming toward him and call it a parade.
Richard Andrews is a professor emeritus of environmental policy at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill.
Environment was just a dramatically popular cause. 4 months into that period, into the 1970s, in April, came the first Earth Day. And it's hard for people today to really imagine how big a celebration that. And it was a celebration, not just an angry protest.
Good evening. A unique day in American history is ending, a day set aside for a nationwide outpouring of mankind seeking its own survival. Earth Day.
There were demonstrations, there were projects, there were things that really added up to the biggest nationwide celebration since the celebrations at the end of World War II.
And in Washington, the dire warning of civil rights leader James Farmer, at the time a Nixon administration official.
We all have a stake, equally. Because if we do not save the environment and save the earth, then whatever we do in civil rights or in a war against poverty will be of no meaning, because then we will have the equality of extinction and the brotherhood of the grave.
Nixon had no environmental policy when he entered office, but he grabbed one quick.
Then he started doing a lot of things administratively to use the president's power to reorganize government, which existed at that time, to create the EPA, to pull together these regulatory functions from the different agencies, put them into one place, and put in charge of them Bill Ruckelshaus, a respected, aggressive prosecutor from Indiana, a Republican, somebody who believed in public service and enforcing the laws.
My feeling was that what we needed to do at EPA was convince the public that we were serious about protecting their health primarily and protecting the environment.
William Ruckelshaus, founding administrator of the EPA.
So we filed a number of enforcement actions. We sued in one day Cleveland, Atlanta, and Detroit, filed actions against big corporations to get them moving toward compliance, to convince them that the government was serious about carrying out the public's wishes.
Did you yourself have any particularly strong feelings about the environment when you got pulled into the EPA?
Oh, yes, I did. I had seen it already in my home state of Indiana, that absent any government interference, not much was going to happen, no matter how bad the situation got. You couldn't rely on the individual causing the pollution to take steps themselves without being pushed by the government on a more or less common basis with their competitors.
So when you say you saw it happening in Indiana, what were you seeing?
Seeing people that were grossly polluting the water and the air, discharging raw sewage into the rivers. It was very clear that something needed to be done. Having attempted to regulate industry from the state, doing that alone in that one state was not going to do it because they would move someplace else. In fact, George Wallace, who was then the governor of Alabama, would take out ads in the Indianapolis newspaper saying, come on down to Alabama. We need the jobs. We don't care about the environment.
But because the EPA established an idea known as environmental federalism, it could set national requirements in Washington and leave it to the states to enforce them. Richard Andrews.
I think Bill Ruckelshaus has referred to EPA as the gorilla in the closet, that the states could then say, you know, we have to do this. All the other states have to do it. EPA is making us do it. And if we don't do it, then the EPA is the backup to do it itself. And surely, Mr. CEO of one of our in-state corporations, you wouldn't want the EPA to be doing this directly to you.
And in fact, the EPA had 10 regional offices, still has.
Yeah.
Half of the EPA staff is out in these offices?
Yes, partly overseeing, but really also partly sort of backing up and assisting the states. They've built enormous capacity at the state level in many states, although their philosophies under different governors vary about how tough they want to be.
And now, according to reports this week, the Trump administration is considering eliminating two of those regional offices. Back to the Nixon era, a bit of a tangent. But during the fallout from Watergate in 1973, William Ruckelshaus was shuffled around, first as acting director of the FBI and then deputy attorney general.
I was only there as deputy for about 23 days before we got involved in a squabble with the White House and the president over Archibald Cox.
The independent prosecutor appointed by the Justice Department to investigate Watergate. Nixon wanted Attorney General Elliot Richardson to fire Cox. Richardson quit in protest. Then the president ordered Ruckelshaus to fire Cox.
Richardson's deputy, William Ruckelshaus, has been fired. Ruckelshaus refused in a moment of constitutional drama to obey a presidential order to fire the special Watergate prosecutor.
The events became known as the Saturday Night Massacre. Afterward, Ruckelshaus took a break from government. In the meantime, the 70s saw the rise of deregulation from airlines to stock markets to telephone companies, and not just under Republicans, Jimmy Carter too. But Richard Andrews said it was Reagan who expanded that philosophy to environmental protections.
Rather than trying to reform or tweak the environmental regulations that had come into play in the 70s, he tried to just reverse them, and it didn't go well.
Reagan nominated Ann Gorsuch Burford as the EPA administrator. Incidentally, her son Neil is Trump's Supreme Court nominee. Ann Gorsuch and most of Reagan's other EPA appointees had no experience in environmental regulation, and so the EPA was blasted for supporting polluters over people and mishandling the Superfund program created to clean up toxic waste.
Critics charge Superfund hasn't been used enough. Because of political delays, or because EPA has been too easy on the industries which polluted. Political delays? Example, the Stringfellow acid pits, where not a penny of the federal Superfund has been spent yet.
More than 20 EPA officials resigned or were fired from the agency. Public outcry led to congressional investigations, and the head of the Superfund account went to prison.
Well, the public was riled up. They were mad. They were angry. They believed that this agency created to protect the environment and their health was being undercut, so they demanded change.
Once again, in the midst of public outcry, Ruckelshaus was asked to run the EPA by a president backed into a corner. When he returned to Washington, he was free to repair the tattered agency any way he saw fit.
It was the one promise I asked the president to make, and that was to let me find the people who could take the place of those who were being replaced. The president looked at me in the Oval Office and said, go ahead, obviously, we don't know what we're doing. So So these were people that had been there before that I'd kept in touch with, and we straightened it out in a big hurry.
You mean you didn't want to drain the swamp of all those experienced bureaucrats?
We didn't think of it as a swamp. It was a wetland, which is to be preserved.
You wrote in the New York Times this week that as you were awaiting Senate confirmation for becoming the EPA chief the second time, you had conversations with the execs at chemical companies that stunned you. They were worried about the EPA having been gutted.
Yes, they really were. This group of chemical manufacturers, which were heavily regulated by EPA, asked to see me, and I assumed they were going to complain about overregulation.
Because that's what happened the first time you were at the EPA.
Yeah, everybody was complaining then. They came in and said just the opposite, that they had no credibility with the public, that the agency charged with regulating their conduct had essentially been eliminated as far as the public was concerned, and that I needed to get in there and start regulating and start showing that the government was serious about protecting public health and the environment.
What were they afraid was going to happen if the public couldn't trust them or the EPA?
Then the public will turn on them and take away their license to operate. They were finding that they had so little support from the public, even from their own employees, that the government needed to step in and say, we're going to protect your health, we're going to keep you safe. They requested that. You need an agency there to ensure that the rules are followed, that the rules are clear and fair and protect the public.
Clean and fair rules, but not too many. In the mid-80s, a Democratic Congress overcorrected for Reagan's cuts by writing environmental laws that directed the EPA to issue a certain number of new requirements a year. And this, according to Richard Andrews, is when the EPA's reputation began to sour.
We'd already regulated the big companies, and so now we were doing things like regulating drinking water and underground storage tanks and things that hit much more heavily on small businesses and local governments.
But still, this issue remained bipartisan for a time.
The first President Bush made maybe the last serious effort to really define himself as a Republican environmentalist president.
I don't have to tell those of you who are hunters and fishermen how important the wetlands are as a habitat for fish and ducks and geese and other waterfowl. But they also help control flooding.
In 1990, he spearheaded the Clean Air Act amendments that gave us cap and trade for sulfur and nitrogen, really one of the most effective innovations in environmental policy we've seen since the 1970s. But in 1992, he was then beaten by Clinton running with Al Gore, who was clearly identified as an environmentalist.
Saving the Earth's environment must and will become the central organizing principle of the post-Cold War world.
Over these several events, the Republican Party generally decided that no matter how much they tried to burnish their environmental credentials, there would always be some Democratic opponent who would push for more government action than they were comfortable with as a party. And so they began to dig in deeper with the anti-environment constituencies and so forth. While the Democrats in turn said, okay, this is our winning issue and the environmental groups can be our ground-level support troops, sort of like teachers. And so my own assessment is I think it's unfortunate that environment has sort of been captured by this increasingly polarized partisan dynamic as a big government issue.
My first day in office, I'm also going to order a review of every single regulation issued over the last 10 years. All needless job-killing regulations will be canceled.
Do you have a sense of deja vu?
Well, it's hard not to. People at EPA are afraid. They're afraid they're going to lose their jobs, that they're going to lose their ability to function as they believe they should. And I would guess that their fear is justified.
What do you think the EPA's number one priority should be now?
Well, I think they should do their job. I think they should do a better job of communicating with the public as to what they're doing and why they're relevant to their lives. I mean, EPA doesn't have a whole lot of constituencies. There's not people who say my favorite agency in the government is the Environmental Protection Agency. Quite the contrary. I also think that there are some legitimate criticisms of EPA. Sometimes regulators and inspectors get arrogant. They push people around unnecessarily. They need to be firm and they need to be fair, but at the same time, they need to recognize that a lot of the people they're dealing with are their customers. They've got to be better at convincing people that they really are on their side. I think also EPA can make some better choices in terms of what they really focus on. It would be a tragedy for this country to drop out of paying attention and taking a leadership role in dealing with climate change. If EPA were to go away, the ability to deal with climate change by our government would be severely compromised.
Why do you think, then, that so many congressmen and senators in the GOP are climate change deniers or agnostics?
Well, it's a number of factors. I think part of it's religious, in the sense that the climate of the world is pretty much predicted by events that will occur in the future by the Bible.
But weren't they just as religious under Nixon and Reagan?
Yes, but they weren't as politically organized. Pollution was smell, touch, and feel kind of stuff. You could see it. So you didn't need to be told it was either coming as part of some biblical revelation. It was there. The climate change is a gradual kind of problem that religiously you can explain it in terms of something that's going to happen anyway. So why worry about it? And there are concerted efforts on the part of the fossil fuel industry, scientists that they hire who will contest the overwhelming number of scientists who say climate change is real and it's coming at an accelerated rate and that we need to do something about controlling carbon and other gases that cause climate change. If we don't do that, then we have to adapt to it, and that's a lot more expensive than trying to mitigate it.
There was a Pew poll last year that found that most Americans, 74%, say that the country should do whatever it takes to protect the environment. But in terms of priorities, the environment ranks below issues like the economy and terrorism. It's almost as if the public is saying, hey, could you just take care of this, but, you know, don't make a big fuss about it?
That's about right. They say, get to it, but it's not our first priority. In fact, when the economy's in trouble, it usually drops down to about the last priority. They think we can get at that when it's everything else is in good shape.
So where does this leave the EPA?
Unless the public rises up and tells their congressman, we won't stand for this, then it will continue to deteriorate in terms of its effectiveness. I think people have to make their voices heard as they are supposed to in a democracy. If they do it, they can stop this deterioration of regulation necessary to protect their health. But if they don't, then it'll continue and we'll be in real trouble.
William Ruckelshaus, founding director and then reconstructor of the EPA under Presidents Nixon and Reagan.
Coming up, the environmental disasters you see, the ones you don't, and the ones that are just too hard to describe.
This is On the Media.
On the Media is brought to you by ZBiotics. Tired of wasting a day on the couch because of a few drinks the night before? ZBiotics Pre-Alcohol Probiotic is here to help. ZBiotics is the world's first genetically engineered probiotic, invented by scientists to feel like your normal self the morning after drinking. ZBiotics breaks down the byproduct of alcohol, which is responsible for rough mornings after. Go to ZBiotics.com/OTM to get 15% off your first order when you use OTM at checkout. ZBiotics is backed with 100% money-back guarantee, so if you're unsatisfied for any reason, they'll refund your money, no questions asked. That's ZBiotics.com/OTM, and use the code OTM at checkout for 15% off.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, The New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.
This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. Journalistic ethics have long tabooed rushing to judgment about the cause of this tornado or that flash flood. Politicians, too, have flinched from drawing a straight line from natural disasters to climate change. Here's a press conference with President Obama in 2012.
Tomorrow you're going up to New York City where you're going to see people who are still suffering the effects of Hurricane Sandy, which many people say is further evidence of how a warming globe is changing our weather. What specifically do you plan to do in a second term to tackle the issue of climate change?
As you know, Mark, we can't attribute any particular weather event to climate change.
But has that abundance of caution mutated into a sort of incautious denialism? Because when President Obama made that claim, the science connecting the weather and the climate, called extreme weather attribution, already had been around for almost a decade. Certainly in the ensuing 4 years, that connection has gotten a lot clearer.
This past March, the National Academy of Sciences released a consensus statement on the state of extreme event attribution, and they made it very clear that it is now possible to attribute individual events to climate change.
Heidi Cullen is the chief scientist at Climate Central, an organization devoted to communicating the science of climate change to the public. For years, she worked at the Weather Channel, and whenever something nasty happened, people would ask her if the cause was climate change, and she hemmed and hawed.
Yes, I did have to hedge, because in the early days, this is 2003, 2004, the answer was, well, you can't attribute any individual event to climate change. And it felt pretty bad. Like, I really wanted to be far more helpful than I was able to be. And I'll never forget when the very first extreme event attribution analysis came out, looking at the European heat wave of 2003. And I finally had something specific and solid to say about an individual event that impacted, I mean, it cost the lives of over 30,000 people in Europe. And we found a very strong climate change fingerprint in that event.
Just to be clear, no individual storm can exactly be traced to climate change. There's no smoking gun.
Just like with cigarette smoking and lung cancer, and I can't say that that cigarette is what caused someone's lung cancer. It's the same thing with climate change and extreme weather. But what we can say is that climate change increased the likelihood or increased the intensity of a specific weather event. You can make a definitive quantitative statement about what role climate change may or may not have played in an individual weather event.
What's the methodology?
It's fairly straightforward. A lot of the techniques actually come from epidemiology. So to go back to the cigarette smoking and lung cancer analysis, you look at what probability can be explained by a given causal factor. And so with extreme event attribution, what climate scientists do is look at, is there a trend, for example? Are there increasing heat waves in this particular area? And then we use climate models to essentially recreate that event. We create a model that is the world as we know it today, and then we create what we call a counterfactual, the world as it would have been without us and all of our global warming pollution. And then we look at the statistics and we say, okay, how likely was an event like this epic flood that hit Louisiana? How likely was that event in the world we live in now with all of the additional greenhouse gases we've put into it versus that event in the past in a completely natural world, if you will? And that's what allows us to do what we call an attribution to climate change or carbon pollution, essentially.
What other recent weather events could you take to court with your comparative models and get a conviction beyond a reasonable doubt?
Heat waves, cold waves, heavy rainfall events, floods, and droughts. And then on the far end, I would say that there's still a lot of work to be done trying to really untangle, say, tornadoes. That's really at the far end of our capabilities. And I'd say that something like hurricane attribution, that's really at the cutting edge right now, and there's some really good groups working on it.
We're talking about the epidemiology of weather. Give me a notion of how good a case you can make. What is the scale of risk that we can now measure?
Well, just as one example that is just really profound, an analysis was done by some colleagues at the University of Melbourne looking at the recent bleaching of the Great Barrier Reef. And what they found was that climate change made that event 175 times more likely. You're basically moving into territory where that event wouldn't have happened in the absence of global warming. That's a pretty profound statement.
So if we're back in court, you can get the verdict from the jury you're looking for.
The evidentiary standards of lawyers are beyond a reasonable doubt. That's 51%. So yeah, I think 175 times more likely is the winner.
It makes me wonder whether the language that we tend to associate with extreme weather, for example, the term natural disaster, is that the right term anymore?
I think that is the beginning of a really long and important conversation. For the longest time, we have viewed our environment and the incredible weather that it produces as an act of God, if you will. And I think that for myself and the colleagues that I work with on rapid attribution analyses, it's to really help provide that context to say, no, if your home got flooded the third time in a row, it's not just because you're unlucky. It's because the system has changed, the odds have increased, and we need to have a conversation about how to deal with the changing nature of these risks.
Now, weather modeling is not new. How is it that it's taken so long for climate scientists to make this case?
For a very long time, the scientific community was focused on the global scale. It was the fact that our planet has warmed up 1.8 degrees Fahrenheit over the past century, over the entire globe. And I think as our computer models got better, as we were able to run them more quickly, we were then able to narrow the time and the space with which we looked at events. It wasn't just temperature or rainfall over the entire Earth. It was this specific event in this specific place.
The premise of this conversation is that the media have been, as a group, reluctant to make connections in reporting about severe weather with climate change. Are we guilty of malpractice? Should we have been on to extreme weather attribution long before this?
I often think about the 2008 economic meltdown and the fact that leading up to that crisis, there was a ton of reporting where we talked about the ups and downs of the stock market and how the housing market was booming, and that broader economic context was missing. And so when the crash actually happened, there's a lot of people who asked, God, why didn't we know about this sooner? And I feel like maybe that's the moment we're at right now. But I do think that there is a true opportunity and in fact, a true responsibility for the media to connect the dots better, because 20 years from now, when things really begin to melt down, the question is going to be, why didn't anyone tell me about this sooner? This science of extreme event attribution is a way to help people finally see what climate change is doing to them and their families and their communities right now.
Heidi, thank you very much.
Thank you, Bob.
Heidi Cullen is the chief scientist at Climate Central. In some ways, our collective anxiety about humanity's effect on the planet literally floats in a giant mass. You've likely heard about it. You can even picture it.
Estimated to be twice the size of Texas, the Great Pacific Garbage Patch stretches from the coast of California all the way to Japan. In some places, the man-made debris is 90 feet deep.
The Great Pacific Garbage Patch, a solid floating landfill of detergent bottles, shopping bags, car tires, volleyballs, cathode ray tubes, and baby toys. Or not. Dan Engber is a columnist for Slate, where he looked below the surface of the garbage patch and found something far more amorphous floating in the sea.
A yachting captain in 1997 came across what he described as a plastic soup He was sailing through a part of the Pacific Ocean where swirling ocean currents kind of gather driftwood and seaweed. And day after day, as he described it, he was seeing garbage in the ocean. And then it wasn't until 2006 that it really started to get a lot of press. And then for maybe 4 years after that, it was everywhere. Still, I think that image of it as floating trash persists.
Some claim the garbage patch in the Pacific Ocean is the size of Texas.
It is a massive floating garbage patch that's double the size of Texas, and it's only
Pacific
getting
garbage
bigger.
Patch, which is just a huge wasteland of plastic and debris, five times the size of Texas.
Than it was the continental United States. The National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration has a website devoted to the size of the garbage patch, and they point out that you can't observe it in satellite photos. If you're sailing through it, you wouldn't even see it. I mean, it's defined as a part of the ocean where there is a higher than normal concentration of tiny microscopic plastic pollution. And it's floating around, and the edges are shifting in the waves. So no one knows how big it is. It doesn't really make much sense to talk about it as continent-sized or twice the size of Texas.
It's degraded plastic?
Yeah, so plastic pollution will break down into smaller and smaller pieces. And in fact, there's reason to think that's more of a concern than tires and cathode ray tubes, because these little bits can make their way into the food chain. So, I mean, there might be more tires floating on average in this part of the ocean than in other parts of the ocean. But, you know, you're not going to run aground on the trash island. And I think it's something where there is a scientifically understood phenomenon that happens to be very different in its real appearance than how almost everyone understands it.
Even the intrepid sailor who got the world's attention to his vivid description back in the 90s began a book by walking back his own description. In 2008, he went on NPR talking about it.
And if it's calm, it sort of looks like a giant salt shaker has sprinkled bits of plastic onto the surface of the ocean.
And in 2009, when Vice did a piece that they called Toxic Garbage Island, they had to have language in there explaining that it wasn't really a garbage.
I came out here expecting to see, you know, like a trash dump. You just see water 1,000 times worse than a Coke bottle. Because what it is it's every part of a Coke bottle busted down into a little digestible morsel.
Yeah, a lot of this coverage includes in the storytelling the discovery that it's not really an island. This debunking has been done so many times now, and it seems to have no effect. The activists on this issue have been talking about how to reframe the discussion of the garbage patch so that it's more truthful. Well, should we call it a plastic soup? Maybe we should call it a micro pollution or plastic smog. But none of these things are as easy to understand and worry about. We see the same problem when we're talking about invisible global warming. We cast about for specific things we can think about, polar bears or measurements of ice caps. The real issues are much harder to quantify. How much damage is it? How does it compare to last year? How will it compare to next year? I mean, it makes me really uncomfortable to think that somehow I and lots of other people got the wrong idea about this. And I was looking at some of those original stories about the Great Pacific Garbage Patch. How did they get this so wrong? And the interesting thing is many of the stories got it right, but the art that went with the stories, photos of trash-filled lagoons in the Philippines or whatever, just to illustrate the idea of garbage in the water. You could read that story carefully, but a month later, when you think back on it, you remember the image that you saw. So I think this is a case where somehow the art might have been more of the problem than the text.
All right, so then your piece in Slate takes an unexpected turn when you conclude that it's actually a benefit to us all that people are making this mistake. Why is it a benefit?
Well, I actually have mixed feelings about it. I think it gets people to care about ocean pollution. Otherwise, if we just kind of knew that all the plastic we throw away breaks down and is distributed uniformly across all the oceans of the planet, it's hard to care that much. But if you can picture every time I toss my soda bottle in the garbage, it's going to end up adding to this volcano of garbage erupting from the Pacific Ocean, that's something you can think about and worry about.
It's so resonant because we all feel like we've contributed to the garbage island.
Yeah, I think that's the power of the image that, you know, everything bad you've ever done to the planet, you toss something in the ocean and you think it disappears into the infinite depths. No, it's all being squeezed together into one spot just to rub it in your face.
And spurs action even from the Congress.
There's a federal microbead pollution act that was passed last year. This gets right at the problem of this microscopic pollution that's so hard to think about. But the activism that led to it comes out of this Great Pacific Garbage Patch moment that took hold 2007-2008.
You compare it to the ozone hole. It's not really a vacuum of ozone over the Antarctic as it's often envisioned.
Yeah, the ozone story is very similar. This is something environmentalists understood was a problem in the 1970s. You know, we're releasing these polluting gases into the atmosphere. They're probably thinning the ozone layer. That's going to be bad for everyone. But it was only in 1985 when it was discovered that the effects of all those polluting gases were concentrated in one spot. So there was a seasonal thinning of the ozone layer in one place, and they came up with this great name for it. They called it the ozone hole.
They say increased ultraviolet radiation through a hole in the ozone could raise temperatures, damage farm crops, and cause a lot more sunburn.
Like this wound had been ripped open in the air surrounding the planet, and that's what led people to really start to worry about it and care about it.
Isn't this just kind of a smoking gun for those who would discredit climate worries as alarmist?
Sure, yeah. You can find websites written by climate change deniers who point to the Great Pacific Garbage Patch as another fraud. I think this is the danger of such things. You know, environmentalists cast about for those images that sort of go viral, that get everyone worked up. You know, it helps in the moment, but I don't know if it works in the long game. Hmm.
Dan, thank you very much.
Thanks for having me.
Dan Engber is a columnist for Slate. He wrote, "There is no island of trash in the Pacific." That's it for this week's show. On the Media is produced by Mira Sharma, Alana Casanova-Burgess, and Jesse Brenneman. We had more help from Michael Loewinger, Sara Kari, Leia Federer, and Kate Bakhtiarova. Special thanks this week to the crack team at WNYC's Archives Department. And our show was edited by Brooke. Our technical director is Jennifer Munson. Our engineers this week were Terrence Bernardo and Sam Baer.
Katya Rogers is our executive producer. Jim Schachter is WNYC's vice president for news. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. On the Media is a production of WNYC Studios. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
Support for On the Media comes from the Overbrook Foundation and the listeners of WNYC Radio.